It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look back at NASA's Cassini mission as it comes to a dramatic end in the atmosphere of Saturn.
But first, according to a draft report from the Department of Justice, trust between the Milwaukee community and its police force is at a critical low.
The report argues that issues like poor departmental communication, a lack of proper community policing, and the overuse of traffic stops leave room for improvement in the police department.
Chuck Krumbach is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Before we get into what's in this report, talk us through what this report is, why it was happening in the first place.
Well, this report was requested by Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn back in the fall of 2015 during the Dontre Hamilton case. He asked the federal government, the Justice Department, to issue a collaborative reform study where, you know, it's like it says, let's collaborate, let's look at the feds, look at Milwaukee and try to reach reforms, positive reforms. The report, as I say, 18, 19 months ago was requested. It didn't come out during the Obama administration fully, but it did come out. And it hasn't been completed, according to the U.S. Justice Department, but this draft was obtained. Rumors of a draft and knowledge of a draft had been around for a while, and then this week the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel published that draft.
What do we know about when this draft was written?
Well, according to the paper and others, it was written about a year ago before, more than a year ago, before the riots or protests, I should say, related to the Sylville Smith shooting, the police shooting in August of 2016. That's an issue because Police Chief Flynn and Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says there have been updates to the report since the version that was published this week came out. Flynn has been calling this report, the draft, having inaccurate data. Barrett has been saying that, listen, there's more to it. There's been some updates that have corrected some things.
So what is in the report that stands out to you, Chuck?
Well, there's several things. I think somewhere around 8 or 9 points, but Brady mentioned a little bit in the newscast there, and I'll go on, is that the traffic stop issue, that African Americans being stopped 3 times more often than white residents. There's an issue of disciplining of officers, whether that's fair and balanced. That the police chief, Ed Flynn, is over-reliant on data. He's made data-driven policing a big part of his time as chief, and the suggestion is that either they're not getting the right data, or they're relying too much on it and not enough on interaction. And finally, mentioned the diversity of officers issue, saying that only about 17% of the police force is African-American, even though the city's population is nearly 40% African-American.
Talking to Chuck Krumbach from WPR News, looking at a newly released or obtained report from the U.S. Department of Justice on the relationship between the Milwaukee Police Department and the community there. And Chuck, a big part of this report focused on the idea of community policing, making the case that community policing is kind of the gold standard of what police departments should do, and that the Milwaukee Department wasn't, at least as of when this draft was written, wasn't doing enough of it. Can you talk about that?
Right. Again, that the suggestion is that there wasn't enough, and the report suggests that there hasn't been enough community, if you will, enough community involvement, reacting to what people are requesting, suggesting, and so on. And that's been a problem. It will. Milwaukee Common Council President Ashante Hamilton yesterday reacted by saying it's important for the police department to take ownership for instances when community trust has been broken, take an honest look at the work that needs to be done, and make a commitment to address these concerns with fidelity and transparency. Fred Royal, the head of the Milwaukee NAACP, said, listen, we think the draft report spells out that the Fire and Police Commission in Milwaukee could be doing more of an annual review of the police department, and maybe suggesting that, you know, the feds don't have to get involved if the local mayor appointed largely a fire and police commission would take a tougher look every year at the police department.
And there's no indication that a final version of this federal report is going to come out, is there?
Right. The Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, put out a statement yesterday, talking about blaming the past administration, that collaborative reform often produced draft reports, often created by contractors. And they're saying that the no draft concerning the Milwaukee Police Department was ever finalized or adopted by the Department of Justice, and reliance on any such draft would be unwarranted, says the Justice Department. And this is in line with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who, of course, has raised some concerns about the collaborative reform program, and back in March of this year issued a memo regarding support for local law enforcement. So collaborative reform is being reviewed by Justice and Attorney General Sessions, and they're saying don't rely on this draft report.
You mentioned Dontre Hamilton and Sylville Smith earlier, and police-involved shootings and reactions to that being a big part of this report. I understand there has been a new police-involved shooting now in Milwaukee, Chuck?
Yes, details are just coming out late this afternoon, but there was apparently an officer-involved shooting at around 29th in Wisconsin on the city's near west side, a very highly traveled area. Individual that was shot has been hospitalized. So another reminder of the importance of police and community relations being key, that what can happen on the street level when things don't go right. Someone gets shot, maybe gets killed at some point, drives home again the importance of this.
As I understand it, this draft report looked at the police department itself and its reaction to a police-involved shooting, but didn't take into account the recent state law that requires an outside investigation into these kind of shootings. Is that right?
And that's my understanding, and that's very key, of course. It may be an issue with the mayor and police chiefs have about it being not being enough updated enough report, but. Yesterday, and we hear get press releases just about every week about police departments or sheriff's departments in one community investigating what's going on in another community. So that's really, in that part of it, it is a really statewide issue to see. The trust issue is key as to whether if a shooting happens in your town, has it been justified or is it going to get a fair review by the next jurisdiction over or the state justice department?
Chuck, I imagine that the police department is thinking about these issues all the time. The Common Council and others are as well. Do you get the sense from the people you've talked to that the release of this draft report is changing anything or making this anything seem more urgent?
Well, there was during the summer, there was a call for the draft report to come out again. There was a suggestion that it existed, that people had it, and Chief Flynn said it wasn't complete. This has come up just in the last 2 months. Here it is back again with the actual publication of the draft report. And it seems that the Common Council, at least in Milwaukee, is going to stay on this for a while. They've scheduled a committee hearing for September 14th looking at the draft report. Alderwoman McLele Coggs says the long-running debate over whether the police department should release the report and how was made moot by its recent publication. So, By the middle of next month, there'll be more on this.
Chuck, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Krumbach, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He's based in Milwaukee, and he joined us today to talk about a draft report from the U.S. Department of Justice, which details a loss of trust, according to the report, between the Milwaukee community and their police department.
And next Tuesday, Milwaukee NAACP President Fred Royal will join us for more on police community relations in the city.
NASA's Cassini spacecraft is preparing to plunge into Saturn's atmosphere in mid-September. They'll burn up the ship and turn it into a meteor, ending the 20-year mission.
Bill Andrews is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and he joins us now for a look back at the Cassini mission and what we've learned from it. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
Well, Bill, in lots of ways, it kind of seems like Cassini is the little spacecraft that could. It kept on going. The missions kept expanding. Tell us how important you think it was to what we know about Saturn.
Oh, I mean, how much time have we got, right? Like, we knew about Saturn. We knew a few things about it. It had seen three probes go past it before, two of the Voyager probes, for example. But there was a lot we didn't know about the planet itself, about the rings, what they were really made of, what the moons were like. There were a bunch of moons. There are a few more now after Cassini's mission. So pretty much the bulk of everything we know about Saturn now is thanks to the Cassini mission, which has been, it launched in 97, so it's been in space about two decades now, 20 years, and it's just rewritten all the books on Saturn at this point.
Talk about the journey to Saturn, first of all. How long did it take Cassini to get there?
So it took years. I mean, Saturn's pretty far out. Jupiter's far out, and Saturn's almost twice as far, and it took about 7 years to get there. Like I said, it launched in 97, and it arrived in orbit in 2004. So a lot of the time was just getting to Saturn. And it got to see some cool stuff along the way. It flew past Venus a couple times and Earth and Jupiter. So there was a lot of fun stuff happening. But the real meat of the mission, what everyone was really excited about, was when it was able to kind of park itself in orbit around Saturn and study, like I said, the planet, the rings, the moons, and just learn all kinds of stuff out there.
And this was a durable little craft. This mission was extended twice. How long was the initial run supposed to be?
It was just 4 years at first, which NASA's getting to be kind of famous for, I don't want to say pessimistic, but conservative estimates on how long their missions will last. I know some of the Mars rovers were just meant for days, you know, 30 days, and they're still there almost 10 years later. And this is another case like that. It was just the initial mission was 4 years, and we'll see where we're at 4 years after orbiting there. And that was 2008, and they said they're still doing good. It's still looking good. There's a lot more work they can do. So they extended the mission once for two more years. And then in 2010, they took another look at things, and they said, we're doing a lot of great work, and everything's going perfectly, and the little probe, Cassini, is happy out there and is doing good work. Let's keep it going. And so it was able to keep going until right about now, until 2017, when finally the gas started to run out.
Right, and that's an important point. It's not that it's breaking. It's not that it's falling apart. It just ran out of gas, in effect.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, gas is kind of an important issue, whether you're in the roadways in the United States or driving anywhere else, or you're out in space, because without gas to determine where you're going, you're purely at the mercy of your momentum and whatever gets in your way. So, yeah, they really had to do something about it just to make sure that this probe didn't end up where they didn't want it to go.
Well, let's talk about some of the findings in a little more depth here. What do you think is the most important thing that Cassini taught us about Saturn?
Oof, maybe just how much we didn't know about it. I mean, to be kind of enigmatic with an answer, right? But it was the other answer is all of the above. Like I said, it's just everything pretty much that we really know now came from that mission. So things about from the rings, if people know one thing about Saturn, is that it has those beautiful rings around it. But we didn't really know all that much about them. We suspected what they were made out of and what kind of particles and pieces and boulders and stuff were out there, but now we know almost, you know, very much more about it. Like, they're mostly water, just ice, just chunks of ice floating out there, reflecting and doing all kinds of cool things. Some of the bits of the rings are smaller than particles of sand, and some are the size of mountains. So it's a really diverse system. It's super flat, about 30 feet thick, which if you consider how big how big Saturn is, and for the rings to go around, 30 feet is like nothing. It's almost flat. So just the rings and all that we learned about the moons. I mean, Titan is one of the biggest moons in the solar system. It's the biggest moon at Saturn. And so we learned all kinds of stuff about the conditions there. Part of the amazingness of the Cassini mission was that it had the Huygens probe attached to it. And that was literally a lander that broke off of Cassini when it got to the right spot and landed on the moon of Titan. It remains the only time we've ever had a landing go on in the outer solar system. And seeing the landscape of this moon of Titan was unbelievable. You could still see movies and GIFs of it online, and it looks very Earth-like is the weirdest part, with lakes, rivers, and mountains and dunes. But instead of the lakes being liquid water, it's liquid methane. Everything is much colder. So it's a familiar-looking world, but still totally different. That's amazing.
I know in a lot of science fiction, Titan is a place that humans end up living at some point or another. I'm not preparing to move and move in by that methane river just yet, but what do we learn about Titan and other moons when it comes to, you know, materials for life?
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, Titan was very instructive for familiar structures, those rivers and lakes, and how weather patterns can be kind of the same, familiar patterns, even though it's totally different materials making them up. But the other amazing thing that Cassini found out was how many of the other moons have liquid water on them. And in fact, one of those moons, Enceladus, has so much water, it's literally bursting through its shell, its icy shell on the outside. There were plumes of water shooting up like geysers from the South Pole, and Cassini saw that, and the scientist said, well, that's weird, let's figure that out, and figured out that there's some kind of pressure, there's hot water coming out of, pushing the water out of the cracks in the ice of the surface. And so after doing a lot of research on the moon's structure and what it could be, it looks like there's a global ocean on this little moon of liquid water. And based on some of the materials in that water, out in the plumes that Cassini's actually flown through it and collected it and sampled it, some interesting materials, some even organic components, so possibly some of the precursors to life-type chemicals. And, I mean, we can't go any further than that, as tempting as it is to say, oh, yeah, sure, aliens, that's where they're at. We don't know that, but we can say that it's maybe possible, which is already amazing, an amazing step that we couldn't before.
We're talking to Bill Andrews right now, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine in Waukesha, and he's joining us to talk about NASA's Cassini mission as it comes to a close in Saturn's atmosphere. And Bill, a lot of questions answered by Cassini. What are the big ones still out there that we don't know?
Well, a surprising one is that we don't know how long a day lasts on Saturn. Its rotation rate is still up in the air because the usual way that you can figure that out on a gas planet with no surface that you could track just how long it takes to make a complete spin. So on those gas planets, you do use a proxy, the magnetosphere, the kind of magnetic bubble around a planet. You can see how long that takes to rotate. But Saturn's magnetosphere is a little weird. It's changed its rotation rate over the years. At first, it was a lot slower when Cassini got there from previous measurements, and Cassini's seen a change. So now we don't really know what's going on with its rotation rate or its magnetosphere. Another one being, of course, are the moons habitable? We don't really know. Maybe that's all we can say now, so that would be a great one to find out. We actually don't know for sure where the rings came from. There's a couple of thoughts on maybe it was a former moon that got too close, pulled apart by the gravity, and the leftovers are now the rings. But we don't know if that's the case or not. So, I mean, there's still a lot going on at Saturn that we will have to wait to find out what the case is.
When I think about the solar system, I think Jupiter's the one with the big storm. And Saturn's the one with the rings. But I was looking at some images. Saturn has, I guess, at the North Pole, a really huge, long-lasting storm too, right?
Yeah, and it's actually in the shape of a hexagon, which is weird. Why would that be? It's a really regular-looking, kind of man-made almost hexagon that's just naturally formed up there. And we'd known about that in the past, but Cassini was able to really get in and study it and saw it change colors over the years. It went from kind of a dark blue, like a Neptune-Uranus kind of color, to the gold that the rest of Saturn kind of looks like, and was able to see also at the South Pole there's another huge storm. There was a ginormous storm that spanned the entire planet in the upper latitudes that Cassini also saw. And I'll also just say real quick, Jupiter also has its own tiny wispy ring system, so they're all getting up in each other's business out in the outer solar system.
And the way that Cassini is going to end, it's sort of Shakespearean. Can you describe Cassini's demise?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost sad because, for me especially, I saw the mission launch on TV all those years ago. I've followed its exploits. I saw those geysers coming out of Enceladus. And I was like, wow, and now it's time. All things must end. And so the NASA people are taking advantage of its upcoming demise, and they're doing all these crazy super close orbits to between the rings and the planet itself, which had never been done before. So they're learning all kinds of new stuff right now just from those, you know, weird, too risky to try otherwise orbits. And then the actual end itself will be so dramatic too, it will actually, I think you mentioned earlier, plummet into the atmosphere of Saturn itself. So this probe that has spent years out there, over a decade, orbiting Saturn and being a part of it metaphorically, is now actually literally going to disintegrate in its atmosphere and become a part of it literally.
And this is a bit of planetary hygiene, I understand, because they didn't want Cassini to end up on one of those moons with possible organic compounds on it and have microbes contaminate what was there, microbes that might have been on it since, I guess, it left Earth.
Right. You never know. Some life can be really hardy. And while there's a whole division at NASA that tries its best to make sure everything that goes out is clean and sterile and pristine, you still never really know for sure. And just in case, like I said, we don't know that there's life, we don't know anything, just on the off chance that there is, we don't want to mess it up. So this is the safest alternative for this. Instead of letting it kind of wander out there, maybe crash land on somewhere, on some alien's house or something, you don't want that. The lawyers, oh, too much. So just shoot it into the planet. It'll disintegrate. It'll come apart just like another meteor would. And, you know, it's all safe from there.
And this is going to happen sometime in September, I think it is. And it sounds like the people who've worked on this mission are kind of emotional. And it sounds like you're going to be a little emotional about this too, Bill. What do they have planned for the end of Cassini?
Well, it's they've been watching its crazy orbits for the last few months. It started in April. Right at the end, to give it that final nudge to go into the planet itself, that big moon Titan will be it'll end up giving kind of a gravitational nudge to the probe. The team actually calls it the goodbye kiss, because it'll change its orbit just enough to shoot the probe into the planet, and everyone will be watching every step of that. The probe's thrusters are going to be doing their best to keep the antenna pointed at Earth, so we'll get data and almost instantaneously. It just takes light a little bit of time to cross that, the transmissions. So at NASA, they're having a whole, I don't want to say party, but a whole group, a media event to witness all the data that comes through at the last minutes, all the possible stuff that they can learn from inside the planet, from beneath its atmosphere in there, until it finally disintegrates, points away from Earth, can't do any more, and then the mission will officially be over, and we'll all shed a metaphorical tear, I think.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. He joined us for a look at NASA's Cassini mission as it comes to a close in Saturn's atmosphere.
Coming up after the news, think earthquakes aren't a threat in the Midwest? Well, think again, says our guest. She says the face of seismic activity is drastically and rapidly changing in the United States. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out why President Trump is calling for an end to the legislative filibuster.
First, since Hurricane Harvey hit Texas last weekend, natural disasters have been at the top of the news. Our next guest says we should be preparing for another kind of disaster, earthquakes, even here in the Midwest.
She says that despite what you might think, earthquakes can happen just about anywhere, and human activity, from building high-rises to drilling for oil, is having an added and significant impact on seismic activity, making the next big earthquake not a matter of if, but a matter of when.
With that in mind, are we as a country ready for the big earthquake to hit, and what do we need to know about earthquakes in order to better understand them and prepare for them?
Catherine Miles joins us now. She's a journalist and writer-in-residence for Green Mountain College. Her new book is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, it's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, Catherine, you start your book talking about a poster someone gave you, a friend, about where earthquakes have been picked up in the United States. And I thought, you know, this poster is going to show a lot of activity on the West Coast, near the San Andreas Fault, maybe up in Washington and Portland area. But you say the whole map is pretty much filled with light for these different trajectories of earthquakes. How can that be?
You know, and we're just now beginning to understand this. You know, historically, we as a country and even scientists really thought that this was a West Coast problem. But as technology improves and we're able to map more and more of the planet, what we're finding is that faults are everywhere. There's 2,100 known faults in the U.S. A good number of them are actually east of the Rockies. And as we begin to understand them better, we're also complicating what we know about them by way of this induced activity.
And the interesting word here in your sentence is known faults. I understand there's actually a lot of possibility. There's many faults we don't know anything about.
There could be exponentially more faults than these 2,100. And the reality of earthquakes in this country is that every major one has actually occurred on a fault that we didn't know about prior to that earthquake activity. And so every year, we're discovering dozens of new faults. And we don't yet know which one of those are capable of a major quake and which ones aren't.
Can you tell us about an earthquake or two that struck not where we would expect, somewhere maybe in the Midwest or the East Coast?
Sure. So your listeners may be familiar with the New Madrid Fault, which runs roughly under the Mississippi River and is a real issue, particularly for places like Memphis and St. Louis. They had a series of three devastating earthquakes in 1811, 1812. We know that fault is reloading. We know that eventually there will be another series of devastating earthquakes. Certainly if that happens in our lifetime, the repercussions are going to be not just for the Midwest, but for the entire country, and that's largely because places like Memphis are such a transportation hub. So much of our commerce passes through either on trucks or as a result of FedEx and UPS having their hubs there. And so it would be crippling for so many more people than just Midwesterners.
And one of the things about earthquakes, obviously there's human costs and the tragedy of loss of the potential of a loss of life in an earthquake, but there's also the cost of it. Earthquakes are really expensive to recover from.
Easily billions of dollars. And it doesn't even take a major quake to do that. There have been some estimates that look at the seismic activity in a place like New York City, which is actually 40 years overdue for another moderate quake. And even that moderate quake could create as much damage, as much cost of damage as we saw in September 11th.
What do you think the United States needs to do to prepare itself? That seems to be the name of the game, and also something that's really hard to do. So what do you recommend?
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing that right now with Harvey and Houston. And in so many ways, these natural disasters, while they manifest in very different ways, the repercussions of them are very similar. And, you know, as a nation, we're really great at responding to crisis. We're really great at helping out one another and, you know, making sure that we're making donations and sending supplies and things like that and really rallying around a community as it's suffering. But we tend to lack imagination and initiative when it comes to that sort of forward looking planning, that anticipating and responding to the disaster before it happens. And that's part of why we have outmoded infrastructure. It's part of why we don't have the same kind of resiliency plans that you see in other countries, and why we haven't invested in things like early warning programs that would really help, you know, give us that lead time of, say, 30 seconds or 60 seconds that could be a matter of life and death.
Do you see a big difference in the level of preparedness for an earthquake between, say, the West Coast, where they've had firsthand experience in the last 50 years, and the rest of the country?
Certainly some. You know, and if we look at a place like California, if there is a silver lining to California's earthquake history, it's that they've learned something crucial about a different infrastructure component each time. So, for instance, in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, the World Series earthquake, we saw that devastating effect to the overpasses and the highways that pancaked. And that resulted in new initiatives and new protocols for highway management there. One particular earthquake really leveled hospitals, and so they put new hospital initiatives in. But even California, you know, has obviously limited funds. Not all of the hospitals, for instance, have been able to make good on those mitigation standards. And even a lot of experts would say that the policies they have in place aren't enough. So it really is a collective problem for all of us.
We're talking to Catherine Miles right now. Her new book is called Quakeland, and we're talking about the science and statistics behind earthquakes in America and the threat that our guest says that they pose in the coming years. And Catherine, looking at the idea of an early warning system, is that possible? Earthquakes, they're notoriously hard to predict, and there's a lot we don't know about them.
That's so true. And I was really surprised by that as I was talking to scientists for this book. They kept saying, you know, we know more about distant galaxies than we do about how the inner workings of our planet behaves. And prediction is something that we once really invested heavily in as a nation, and it's so far really proven elusive and probably always will be. But there's a difference between prediction, which is saying, hey, 6 months from now, there's going to be an earthquake in L.A., to an early warning system, which is something that countries like Japan and Mexico already have in place. And this is something that, you know, would use your smartphone technology, would send you a text that says, you know, earthquake coming, you know, magnitude 6.1, 45 seconds. And that may not seem like a lot of time, but it's enough time to take shelter under a table. It's enough time to divert an airplane that's about to land or close a tunnel to prevent people from getting trapped.
Wow. So what sort of potential is there for warning with earthquakes? How much time can you get? You know, with a tornado, you can see it coming, you can gauge the conditions. What kind of warning is there for earthquakes?
Not nearly as much. And that's part of what makes earthquakes so terrifying. There's this new emerging field of psychology which looks at the effect of disasters on people's psyches. And what they found is that people have a far more visceral and damaging reaction to earthquakes that lasts a lot longer, a kind of PTSD-type phenomenon that seems more extreme than people who have experienced tornadoes and fires and hurricanes. And one reason is because it is so unknowable, and we don't know that it's coming. We don't see the skies gray up or turn that weird color of green that often happens before a tornado. We don't have the day or days that we have with a hurricane, and that's very unsettling.
What did the scientists that you talked to tell you about the cutting edge of earthquake science, what they really want to know and what they're close to finding out?
We still don't know what causes earthquakes to happen. We still don't really know. I mean, we understand that it's pressure differentials. It's a growing pressure. There's an emerging field of study that really suggests that hydrology is a lot more crucially involved than we ever thought. But, you know, when we see little earthquakes starting to happen sometimes, we can't really predict whether they're sort of harbingers of a big quake or whether they're just a little bit of seismic activity. It's such a new science. You know, even well into the 1960s, plate tectonics was considered highly suspicious as a sound theory, you know? So it's really a field in its infancy.
And when we talk about plate tectonics, I think most of us think, you know, plate tectonics, that's what's happening when an earthquake happens. The plates are shifting and they bump over one another or under, and then you've got your earthquake. But you say in your book that human activity is a big contributor.
Huge contributor, and that's been the big game changer of this century. Certainly prior to that, as long as we've been doing things like mining, like oil extraction, we've been causing earthquakes. But it's not really until this century that we've seen the full effect of that. And, you know, the most obvious example, of course, is what's happening in Oklahoma right now, where wastewater injection related with fracking is causing hundreds and hundreds of quakes a year, some of which are doing actual damage. But the surprise for me in this book was learning that fracking is literally the tip of the iceberg when it comes to induced seismicity. When Hoover Dam was built, the filling of Lake Mead, that reservoir there, created something like 10,000 earthquakes over the course of a decade. And it's even things, as you mentioned in the intro, things like the construction of these super high-rise buildings in places like Taipei, tunneling, mining, all of them are contributing to seismicity in a very real way.
And moving water, you say, tends to be a big contributor.
And this is what we're just beginning to understand. We've certainly seen, for instance, you know, an earthquake that happened in 1959 outside of Yellowstone significantly affected well levels in places like Puerto Rico. So we see that there's obviously a connection. One earthquake that happened in Pennsylvania about a decade or so ago caused all of the wells there to run dry and created wells and springs, you know, in Ohio where there hadn't been any. So we understand that there's fluidity. We understand, obviously, that water underground is held at pressure. But the degree to which its movement literally triggers earthquakes is still something of a mystery.
We're talking right now with journalist and author Catherine Miles about her new book called Quakeland, talking about the science of earthquakes.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever lived through an earthquake? What was that like? Do you think we as a nation are ready for earthquakes, taking enough precautions? And what questions do you have about the science of earthquakes? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit right here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now to journalist and author Catherine Miles about her new book called Quakeland. And she's making the case that earthquakes pose a huge threat to the United States in the coming years and decades, and that policymakers need to be doing more to get ready for that reality.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that's on your radar? Would you know what to do if an earthquake hit? Is this a threat that the government needs to take more seriously? And what kind of response do we need to be ready to have? And what questions do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Catherine, when you talk about preparedness, part of that is policy. What do you think that policymakers need to be doing to get ready for the threat of future earthquakes, especially when we see firsthand right now in our country the devastation after Hurricane Harvey?
Yes, and this is, again, you know, we see so many similarities between these catastrophic disasters. And, you know, one thing we know is that for decades we have been dramatically underfunding our nation's infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers gives our infrastructure a report card grade every few years. And for the past several of these report card cycles, we've earned a D average. And some particularly vulnerable areas of our infrastructure have earned even lower grades, things in particular like our dams and our levees. So this is something that really, you know, we need to own sooner rather than later, and not just because of a catastrophic natural disaster, but because it's interfering with efficiencies as well, too. So taking the time to actually shore up our grid, to really spend the money on our roads and bridges, our airports, our levies, is something that's long overdue and really just can't wait any longer.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Darren joining us from Wyawega. Darren, hi.
How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Well, the comment I was going to give you was about living through an earthquake in Idaho in the 80s. But it goes back to the infrastructure part you just talked about, because the day the earthquake happened was the day we were moving from our old traditional high school brick and mortar false front to our brand new one that was built by the mining industry. And the old high school was destroyed in the earthquake, but the new one stood the test because it had to follow all the new codes. It was just perfect timing for that part, but not so much for the earthquake.
Wow, that's an incredible story, Darren. Thank you for that. Darren has got a firsthand story of why it matters that we take into stock, you know, whether or not our buildings are ready to go in an event like that, Catherine.
That's right. And, you know, the idea that we can build buildings that do respond well to things like earthquakes is absolutely true, and absolutely something that we should be looking at. One of the things I detail in the book is a community in the Pacific Northwest who took the opportunity of building a new school to introduce a new bond initiative and created this very sophisticated tsunami platform so that all the kids can shelter in place. And that's the kind of forward thinking that we need to see more of.
Is there cross-pollination in scientists around the world? For example, Japan, where there are earthquakes happening quite a lot comparatively to some places in the United States, I would imagine that the building technology and engineering is different or more advanced in some cases.
Yes and no. If you look at, for instance, New Zealand, our building codes are remarkably similar, and our buildings are also remarkably similar. You know, this really is a global problem, and I think we all have a lot to learn from one another. Interestingly enough, you know, some of those kind of indigenous structures that look very not sophisticated to our naked eye, are ones that do remarkably well in earthquakes. We saw this in places like Mexico City and in Chile during the last big earthquake. You know, some of the newer buildings, you know, were kind of crumbling while these very old, you know, seem like crudely built buildings were the ones that were able to absorb the strain.
Let's take another caller now. Let's go to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi, I was wondering, with these little quakes, does that relieve pressure a little at a time so then maybe there won't be such a big earthquake?
And Dennis, thanks for that. Catherine, with little earthquakes, do seismologists know whether that does anything to kind of stave off a big one later on?
That's a great question. We're not entirely sure. They're what's called precursory action. Sometimes it just seems like these little quakes are just almost kind of like a little bit of a burp that's happening. But these little quakes can also be harbingers, foreshocks, if you will, for a much larger quake. What we're also learning is that these little quakes can shift the pressure and cause a bigger earthquake somewhere else. And so there's been a lot of study lately about how one quake, say, you know, in San Francisco can in fact cause an earthquake right down that San Andreas fault zone all the way down into, say, L.A. So maybe, but then they also may complicate things.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dennis. Appreciate that. And Catherine, you went to some really unusual places in the writing of this book. One of them, you went deep underground in a silver mine. What did you do there? What did you learn?
Yeah, I wanted this book to sort of be the classic road trip narrative. You know, I didn't want readers to think that this was a regional problem, and that seemed like the way to do it. The silver mine was fascinating. This is one of the deepest mines in the country. It's in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and I spent a day with the staff geologist there, and we were down at depths of well over a mile, down at depths as low as 7,100 feet, where the temperature can be 130 degrees. And as these mines get deeper, particularly in places like the U.S. and South Africa, which has some of the deepest mines in the world, we're exerting more and more pressure, more and more influence on the ground down there. And what used to be known as rock bursts, these moments that, you know, unfortunately would maybe, you know, kill a few miners underground, but wouldn't do a lot of damage above ground, are now creating real seismic events that are having real consequences.
Is it surprising to you at all, as it is to me, in hearing stories like that about a mine going deep enough that it could interfere with the stability underneath? Because I think about the plates as being way deep in the center of the earth, being so far down that it's not something that our little human technology can really get close to touching.
Yeah, and you know, that's, you know, that turns out not to be the case. We don't actually have to go down very far. And it doesn't even have to be at the edge of a plate. One of the more interesting stories that I detail in the book is this town of Plainfield, Connecticut, which in recorded history had never really had an earthquake, and a few years ago had 300 over the course of about 6 months. And we think it's because water seeped into an abandoned quarry and froze and thawed and froze and thawed over the course of a winter, and that created this bizarre earthquake swarm, which really unsettled the town.
I can imagine. Well, let's take another caller. Let's go to Philip in Eau Claire. Philip, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Not bad. How are you?
Doing pretty good. My question is, I'm originally from southern Illinois, actually south of St. Louis, and I know the New Madrid Fault goes through that area. Back when I was in college in the 80s, our rock instructor... our geology instructor was talking to us about the fact that that area of the country had, at that point, was having about 150 to 200 earthquakes a year that were so deep that they couldn't be felt. And he said that the fear is, and that, you know, I'm just curious as to what it is now, that he said within the next 50 to 100 years that those earthquakes will probably come to the surface and will be so tremendous and so dangerous because of all of the mining that has been done throughout the Midwest and especially in Illinois, the coal mines, that it will make anything that's ever happened in California look like a child's game.
Wow. Well, that's terrifying. Philip, Catherine, is there anything to that?
I don't know anything about the direct correlation between mining and the New Madrid seismic zone. That's not something I came across. But certainly the threat of a major earthquake on the New Madrid zone is very real. You know, through study, we've identified three sets of earthquakes that have happened over the course of sort of geologic time there. They occurred at roughly about 400 years apart. That's not really a large enough sample size to say that we know when the next one's going to happen, but we do know that there were three very devastating earthquakes in 1811 there, naturally caused, that were above an 8.0, which certainly makes them significant, and that those are probably going to happen again. Will it happen today? Will it happen in 100 years? We don't know. But what emergency managers and planners say, look, it doesn't matter if it happens now or in 100 years. We really need to get ready for it right now.
Well, Philip, thank you so much. And Catherine, appreciate you joining us today. In a couple seconds left here, what can we do to get ready, maybe on the personal level?
Absolutely. You know, and in an afternoon, we can do so much. We can pack a go bag with supplies. We can make sure that our bookcases are bolted to walls. We can make sure that we have a plan of communication if our cell phones go down. And this is something we should be doing for any disaster.
Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Catherine Miles, a journalist and writer in residence for Green Mountain College. Her new book is called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. What about you? Have you lived through an earthquake? Lynn on Facebook says she was in Los Angeles in 1971 for the San Fernando earthquake. My reaction to this was astounding, she says. Took me days to recover my normal activity. We'd love to hear your story. And what you think we need to do going forward, change policy, get ready, make disaster plans for our families. Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're not always Johnny on the spot when it comes to new words on social media, and that's why we have producers.
That's right, and today one of them introduced us to a brand new term, at least. It's called JOMO, the opposite of FOMO, which is coined by writer Sherry Turkle, which stands for, if you don't already know, fear of missing out. It's that feeling when you kind of obsessively check your social media accounts in case everyone is doing something awesome without you.
That's FOMO, fear of missing out. This new one to us, joy of missing out, JOMO. According to the internet, a reliable source, of course, the term JOMO first appeared in a blog post way back in 2011.
And I kind of like this term. I think you said you do too, Rob. As two people who like staying in some of the time, it does seem to capture that feeling you get when you think, you know, I would really rather be at home, and I'm glad to be here.
And I thought of it in another way, too. You know, for a while in my life, I thought, oh, there's so many, you say, books to read, and there's no way I'm going to read them all, and there's this should stack of books that I should read someday. And once I forgave myself and let myself out, I felt really good. I am having the joy of missing out, and I just read what I want to.
Joy of not reading books. That doesn't
I read other books, just not those books that I'm supposed to read.
Right. Well, I think I relate to the idea of not always being out there doing.
True.
I used
too,
to overprogram myself. I tried to scale it down. And I really like, you know, I started to like winter for that reason, because it's okay to stay inside.
It's the joy of slacking here on Central Time.